Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. It's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. So what I thought I'd do this afternoon is continue the comparative embryology that Mickey introduced us to, and use the next half an hour to talk about comparing mouse and human development. And based on the excellent foundation that Mickey gave us this morning, I know everyone in this room now is an expert embryologist, so I'm going to start with a little quiz for you. So one of these embryos is human, and one of these is mouse. And you have to decide which is which. So you've got 10 seconds. So who thinks the human embryo is on the left? And who thinks the human embryo is on the right? And who didn't put their hand up? Okay, I'll let you mark your own work.
Yes,
but hopefully there was a big clue in the picture, right? You can see the tail of the mouse embryo here. There's a little bit of the human tail left. I made this more difficult for you because I did the heads are removed from both of these embryos. So it is a difficult test, so don't feel bad. But I hope what this shows you is, first of all, just morphologically, how similar mammalian embryos are at this stage of development. Not only are they similar morphologically, but they're also similar sizes, right? So, you know, these are sitting next to each other in a petri dish. They really are very similar in size at these stages of development. So we're interested in trying to understand the similarities and differences during the development of tissues at these early stages of development. And for many years, I've had an interest in the spinal cord. So it's the most evolutionary conserved region of the nervous system. It has largely the same organization throughout all vertebrates and throughout all mammals. It was the first part of the nervous system to evolve, and it functions to control and coordinate movement. And yeah, that's the foundation of why we have a nervous system. So I think it's interesting to study human spinal cord evolution for a couple of reasons. So understand what is common between all vertebrates, but also humans are not identical to other animals. We do have some unique properties. We have different gaits from other animals. We have fine motor control that allows us to manipulate tools and keyboards and so on. So I think understanding the similarities and differences will give us some insight into what are crucial novelties that led to human differences, as well as understand some of the fundamental principles. So the basic organization of the nervous system, including the spinal cord, arises early in development. And the diversity and organization of neurons within the spinal cord is achieved by the spatial segregation of proliferating progenitors. And this relies on patterns of gene expression which divide progenitors along both the dorsal ventral, so back to belly, and anterior posterior, so head to tail axes. And changing this transcriptional code within progenitors has predictable consequences on neuronal subtype generation. So the problem of understanding nervous system development becomes one of understanding how you generate these patterns of gene expression in progenitors. And if we look along the dorsal ventral axis at spatial patterns of gene expression in the mouse and human spinal cord, again, you can see very similar patterns in mouse and human. And over developmental time, you see a similar sort of evolution of those patterns, a similar changes in the patterns of gene expression. And again, there's a test for you there. One is mouse, one is human. And again, I hope maybe it's even more difficult. I think most of us wouldn't be able to tell the difference if we didn't know beforehand. So overall, in the spinal cord, mouse and human spinal cord at these early stages of development look very similar. So we wanted to get more systematic about this and ask, you know, what are the similarities and what are the differences? And one approach we've taken is to comprehensively profile using single-cell transcriptomics both mouse and human spinal cord at these stages of development where pattern is being produced and neurons are being generated. And I won't go through all the details of this, as Claude adequately demonstrated. I understand there is some kind of legal requirement to show a UMAP whenever you do single cell transcriptomics. So here is a UMAP. But because we know already so much about pattern of gene expression in the spinal cord, we can actually use our prior knowledge rather than unsupervised methods to analyze the data. And that's what we've done. We know combinations of gene expression that allow us to uniquely identify different progenitor domains, and again, another set of transcription factors and other gene expression that allows us to uniquely identify distinct neuronal subtypes. So using our prior knowledge, we can classify each of the cells in our single cell transcriptome data into a particular category of progenitor or particular neuronal subtype, and then begin to compare between mouse and human the equivalent cell types. So if we do that, so here we're comparing the transcriptional similarity between progenitors and neurons in mouse and human. We've used expression levels of homologous genes in each of the cell types in mouse and human and estimated the Pearson correlation between those pairs of cell types. And what you can see is that there's a strong main diagonal here suggesting that there's the greatest similarity between the same cell types in mouse and human. You can see that progenitors are more similar to each other than neurons, and on average, there's in the progenitors, the closer you are in space, the more similar you are transcriptionally. Whereas interestingly, if you look at the neurons, we can divide them into excitatory and inhibitory interneurons. But overall, this is suggesting that grossly there's a strong similarity in the transcriptional profile of the equivalent cell types in mouse and human. So this is spatial patterning. For Claude, I also just wanted to mention the temporal program as well. So a few years ago, Andreas Sagner in my lab, I realized there's also a temporal program operating in the spinal cord and actually throughout the nervous system in a very similar way to Claude's, like different genes, but the same strategy, in which neurons generated at different times can be identified by a unique transcriptional program specified by specific transcription factors. And indeed, actually very similar to the strategy that Claude outlined, this temporal stratification program acts orthogonally to the spatial program, so you get that combinatorial effect of the temporal and spatial identity of neuronal subtypes. So this was, we originally identified this in the mouse, but now having the human transcriptional data, we could ask whether we see the same temporal program in humans, and indeed we can. So again, looking at each of those spatial neuronal subtypes and progenitor types, we can see exactly the same temporal program operating in the human as in the mouse, and using the same set of transcription factors. So overall, there's a strong similarity in both the spatial and temporal patterning between human and mouse. However, there are differences, and I want to talk about those differences. I'm going to divide those into four categories: as changes in genes, changes in the expression patterns of some genes, changes in the proportion of cell types between mouse and human, and finally, changes in the tempo, the pace of development. So if we start at the top and just work through these categories. So there are a set, an increasing number of recognized primate-specific and indeed human-specific genes. And most of these have been, where they've been looked at, very little as actually work has been done on them, but Pierre and others have looked at some of these. And where they've been looked at, the main focus has been in cortical neurons, with the idea that these contribute to human-specific features of cortical development. But now having the comprehensive data set from other regions of the nervous system, we can begin to ask whether primate-specific or human-specific genes are also expressed in the spinal cord. And indeed they are. So here's just a small list of those where we can see that some of these genes are expressed in spinal cord progenitors and neurons. For most cases, we know very little, if anything, about the function or properties of these genes. I just highlighted TM14B at the top there, because work that has been done on that suggests that in the cortex, in human cortex, it marks outer radial glial cells, so the which is a sort of a human or primate specific population of cells, and has been implicated in promoting cortical expansion and actually the gyrification, the folding of the brain. So what it's doing in the spinal cord, I'm not quite sure, but I think, again, comparing the function of some of these genes in the spinal cord with the brain might give us some insight into what, if anything, these primate specific genes are doing. So in addition to primate-specific genes, what we also notice is that there are some changes in gene expression between mouse and human. So here we're comparing gene expression with a catalogue of progenitor-specific markers between human and mouse. And if you look at this overview, then you can see essentially it looks very similar between mouse and human. But if you squint hard, you can begin to see some differences in expression. So I'm just going to highlight one. So, you know, you may not even see this, but this gene here, PAX7, is expressed in both mouse and human in dorsal neural progenitors. But what the transcriptomics suggested is that in human, it should also have some expression in the most ventral cell type, the floor plate. So we wanted to validate this. We wanted to explore whether this transcriptional prediction was indeed the case. And it is the case. So from Kate Story's lab, so Kate Story looked at the expression of PAX6 protein in early section of a human spinal cord. And as well as that expression in the dorsal half of the spinal cord, you can see cells in the very, very ventral midline, the floor plate, also express PAX7. This is not seen in mouse or chick or other vertebrates that have been examined so far. So this looks human or maybe primate-specific expression of PAX7. So we can see this if we look at the transcriptome of human floor plate cells. Along with PAX7, we have a whole set of genes which are expressed in the human floor plate. And we can compare that with the transcriptome of mouse floor plate cells. So you can see that in contrast to human floor plate, mouse floor plate lacks PAX7. In addition, there are several other genes which are also not expressed in the mouse floor plate, but we do find in the human floor plate. So this raises the possibility that the expression of PAX7 in the human floor plate has co-opted a gene expression program that it isn't expressed in the mouse floor plate, but co-opted that expression into the human floor plate. And if we look at those genes which are not expressed in the mouse floor plate, we do see them expressed in both the human and mouse dorsal neural tube. So it looks like the co-option of a little transcriptional module, a little transcriptional program from the dorsal neural tube into the floor plate in human. What significance that has, we don't know, but it'd be something interesting to begin to explore. Then in addition to differences in the spatial expression of genes between mouse and human, what you can also notice is that there's differences in proportions of cell types. So although there's the same overall pattern of gene expression, the size of some of those domains, the relative sizes of those domains, differs between mouse and human. And I'm just going to focus on one example of that. So in the ventral neural tube in the mouse, there's this red domain of progenitors which expresses NKX22, which abuts the domain of progenitors which expresses OLIG2, which will go on to produce somatic motor neurons. And there are very few, if any, cells which express both OLIG2 and NKX22 in mouse. By contrast, if you look at the situation in the human, again, you see the same spatial relationship between the red and blue cells, but now you can find a much higher proportion of those double positive, those OLIG2, NKX22 expressing cells. So it seems there's been an expansion in that particular cell state in the human compared to the mouse. And working at Columbia University, Hinnik Victorli and colleagues also noticed this from in vitro differentiation, directed differentiation of human ES cells to motor neurons. They also noticed that in contrast to mouse, they found a set of progenitors in vitro that expressed OLIG2 and NKX22, and they used that to profile those progenitors further. And what they noticed is looking at those double positive cells, so the OLIG2 cells which expressed NKX22, they were enriched for markers for transcription factors and other markers which are characteristic of less mature, so proliferative progenitors, so pre-neurogenic progenitors. So one possibility is that this increase in the NKX22 OLIG2 expressing progenitors reserves a population of progenitors that allows the greater expansion of motor neuron production in human compared to mouse, which may be contributing to the production of more motor neurons necessary for the fine motor control humans and primates have. But that, of course, needs to be tested. But there's still a question of why that is. So what are the changes that allow the expansion of this population of cells in human? And one thing we've noticed is that we can actually generate OLIG2, NKX22, this special population of progenitors in mouse in vitro differentiations by changing the relative proportions of different signals, so actually increasing the level of retinoic acid in vitro. So we can generate this population from mouse ES cells, but we see them very rarely in vivo. So it raises the possibility that, you know, one hypothesis here is that there's a change in the signaling, the spatial temporal profile of signaling in mouse embryos compared to human embryos, and that changes the proportions of cell types in the spinal cord. Okay, so that was changes in proportions of cell types. What we also notice, and what was beautifully introduced this morning, is that there's a big difference in the pace of development between mouse and human. And so the sections, the period of development I've been focused on today in mouse represents about a 3 or 4 day period, so from about E9 to about embryonic day 9 to about embryonic day 12 in mouse. The equivalent period of human development goes from about Carnegie stage 11 to Carnegie stage 17, 19. And this covers a period of a couple of weeks. So from about week 4 after fertilization to about week 6, maybe week 6.5 after fertilization. So the same processes are happening, but over a much extended period of time in the human compared to mouse. So we're interested in trying to understand what the basis of this difference in tempo was. And one way we've approached this is to use in vitro models. So to take advantage of the directed differentiation of mouse and human stem cells to motor neurons. So we and others over the last decade or two have developed methods to take pluripotent ES cells and convert them into motor neurons by recapitulating the signaling events that are normally involved in motor neuron generation in vivo. So we can start with either mouse or human ES cells, expose these to a set of signals, and we're using exactly the same media, the same signals at the same concentrations in mouse and human ES cells, and convert these into first neural cells, motor neuron progenitors, and then into post-mitotic motor neurons. And as you can see here with a series of markers, we can do this both for mouse and for human ES cells. And we see the same markers appearing in the same sequence in both mouse and human. But what you can already notice from the labels here is that it takes 2 to 3 times longer for this process using human ES cells than it does for mouse ES cells. So I think this says a couple of things. So first of all, it says that we can recapitulate these processes in vitro. And whatever the temporal mechanism is, whatever is setting the pace of development, it's either cell autonomous or at least only dependent on local interactions. You don't need the rest of the body there for this difference in tempo between mouse and human. It's just local signaling or cell autonomous signaling going on. And I think this is further emphasized if we look at the whole transcriptome. So we can analyze a transcriptome in vitro in both mouse and human every day or every half a day during process of from progenitors to postmitotic neurons. And you can see there's a really strong correlation. There's the same transcriptional changes in both mouse and human as you progress from progenitor to neuron. But it's happening twice as fast in mouse as it is in human. So if you look at day three, that sort of around correlates with around about day 7 or 8 in mouse. So same process unfolding at different rates. So what accounts for that? So like Mickey and others, we've looked at various possibilities, and I'm not going to go through all of the negative results, but we could rule out that it doesn't appear to be about differences in protein sequence, doesn't appear to be about differences in cis-regulatory elements. If we put human cis-regulatory elements controlling human genes into the mouse ES cells, they take on mouse time. So what is it? So what we did see, similar to what Mickey showed you in PSM cells, is we found that protein stability differed substantially between human and mouse. So if we look at here the whole proteome in neural progenitors, we can see the proteome in mouse has half-life of around about 6-7 hours, whereas human on the equivalent neural progenitor, in the equivalent neural progenitor cells, has a half-life 2 to 3 times longer, so up around 17, 20 hours. And this is true if we look at individual proteins as well. So if we look at a couple of our favorite transcription factors involved in motor neuron progenitor production, we can see that the same transcription factors in mouse have half the stability of those in the same transcription factor in human cells. So there's this twofold difference in half-life protein stability between mouse and human. So this is not only in the PSM now, this is looking in neural progenitors. So that seems to be the same in these different tissues. So we've also looked at other biochemical rates. We've looked at translation rate. We don't see an obvious difference in using a couple of different techniques, an obvious difference in translation rates between mouse and human. So we've got a difference in the half-life, but not in the production rate. If we look at the size of neural progenitors between mouse and human, they're about the same size. So human neural progenitors are slightly bigger, but there's not a huge difference in the size of mouse and human neural progenitors. So if you put all of that together, that should mean there's a higher protein content in human neural progenitors. And indeed, if we measure that, that does seem to be the case. Okay. So there's this difference in protein stability. So could that account for this difference in tempo? And one way we can examine this is computationally. So over the years, we've developed several computational mathematical models that look at the gene regulatory network, the sequence of gene regulations that generate motor neuron progenitors and motor neurons. And now that we've measured protein half-lives, we can plug those numbers into these models. And so if we do that using the measured half-lives from the mouse data, we see a series of changes in transcription, a sequence of gene expression events generated by a particular gene regulatory network. And you can see this unfolds at a characteristic time, which actually corresponds pretty closely to what we're seeing in vivo. And actually, another point to make here is that these processes take a period of 12 hours or so, which is substantially longer than the segmentation clock you heard about earlier. So this is using numbers from the mouse. If we take exactly the same model, but just use the kinetic parameter we measured for degradation we've measured in human, then you can see the same sequence of events, but now it takes 2 to 3 times longer to unfold. So computationally, so in these models, then changing the degradation rate is sufficient to change the tempo of this transcriptional network. But can we test this this experimentally? So to do this, we focused on one particular transcriptional or one particular regulation event. So this is cross inhibition between the transcription factor IRAK3 and OLIG2. So hedgehog signaling induces OLIG2 expression, but IRAK4 is expressed before that and represses OLIG2. So the induction of OLIG2 depends on the repression of IRAK4, and that sets when OLIG2 is induced by hedgehog signaling. So the prediction is if we can change the stability of IRAK4, we should be able to accelerate the pace at which OLIG2 is induced. And so to do this, we've taken advantage. We've constructed an ES cell, so a transgenic line in which we've hooked up IRAK4 to a protein tag, a halo tag, and then we can introduce a PROTAC molecule, so a small molecule that interacts with that halo tag, which then recruits the proteasome pathway and degrades IRAK4. So this is a way to conditionally increase the turnover, decrease the half-life of IRAK4 by introducing a small molecule. So we can do this now with the IRAK4 halo-tagged cell line in the presence or absence of the halo PROTAC. So if we just look at the control cell line first, so the untreated cell line, you can see when we add a hedgehog agonist, then over a period of time, IRAK4 is repressed, and we see induction of OLIG2. And it takes about a day or so to repress IRAK4, a day and a half or so to get induction of OLIG2. Now we can do exactly the same experiment, but introducing the PROTAC at the same time as we introduce the hedgehog agonist, so we're decreasing the stability, increasing the turnover of IRAK4. And what we see in that case is a more rapid downregulation of IRAK4 and consequently an accelerated induction of OLIG2. So experimentally, if we manipulate the stability, the half-life of IRAK4, we can change the tempo of OLIG2 induction. So that's consistent with protein stability contributing to this difference in tempo between species. But is this restricted to the gene regulatory network? So we've begun to measure other properties of differentiating neural progenitors. So one thing we can do is look at the cell cycle rate of progenitors between mouse and human. Again, this is looking at neural progenitors, and if we compare mouse neural progenitors to human neural progenitors, we see that the cell cycle is twice as fast, two and a half times faster in mouse neural progenitors than in human neural progenitors. So recovering the same difference in tempo again when we look at cell cycle, which is sort of unrelated or probably unrelated to the gene regulatory network. But of course, this raises another possibility. So the turnover of proteins, the cell cycle, so cell division, can also contribute to the dilution, the turnover of proteins. So does that difference in protein stability between mouse and human, is that also cell cycle related? So we don't think so, and the reason we don't think so is we can also measure the difference in protein stability in post-mitotic neurons. So we can differentiate these neural progenitors to motor neurons and then measure turnover of proteins in either mouse or human motor neuron, differentiated post-mitotic motor neurons, so there's no cell cycle operating here. And just as in progenitors, in these post-mitotic cells, we see this 2-3-fold difference in protein stability in neurons. So whatever is contributing to this overall change in protein stability, it doesn't seem to be solely dependent on the cell cycle. But we can also measure other features as well of post-mitotic neurons. So one thing we can do, and we've done this with our colleague Andrea Sirio at the Francis Crick Institute, is to measure the rate of motor neuron axon elongation. So using an engineered device that he's developed, we can look at motor axons from human motor neurons or from mouse motor neurons. And I hope what you can see here is that the mouse motor neuron axons seem to be speeding ahead of the human axons. And indeed, if we quantify this, we can actually get the rate of axon elongation. And what you can see again is this, again, a 2-3-fold difference in the speed of axon elongation. So With humans, it looks like about 20 microns per hour. With mouse, it's, you know, the Ferraris of the motor axon world at 42, almost 42 microns per hour. So this seems to be very unlikely to be sort of related to that gene regulatory network directly, right? This, again, we're getting this 2 to 3-fold difference between mouse and human. So what underlies this? And I think just thinking sort of the functional significance of this, this sort of makes sense, right? So if you're building a body, you want the axons to reach the muscles at the time they're ready to be innervated. So it makes no sense for axons to grow faster or slower than the rest of the body is developing. So somehow it makes sense that these differences in tempo span across these different processes, but it still begs the question of what could be the underlying cause. And as Mickey has already introduced to you, one possibility is that underlying all of this is some differences in metabolic rate between species, and I'm sure we're going to hear more about this in subsequent talks. And I think this is an attractive possibility, not least because there's a long-standing observation called Kleebler's Law, where there's a strong correlation between size, so eventual body size, longevity, gestational period, and actually recently that's also been extended to protein half-life. So there seems to be some connection between these that we're still not fully understanding. So we've been interested in trying to measure metabolic rate, and I'm afraid we haven't got very far yet, but what I can say is that at least from our first assays, we're not seeing an obvious difference in metabolic rate from between mouse and human neural progenitors, which contrasts with work that Mickey showed today in a different cell type. So I should say, as we say in this lab, in the lab, this is still WIP. This is still very much work in progress. But we want to explore this more and understand whether there are differences in metabolic rate between species and whether these are similar or different between different tissues. And I hope to be able to tell you more in the future. But I'm going to wrap up there. So I told you about similarities and differences between mouse and human spinal cord development. I told you about there's differences in genes, differences in the expression pattern of genes, differences in proportions of cell types, and differences in the tempo of development. So I'm going to stop there. I just want to acknowledge people in my lab. In particular, I want to highlight Teresa Rayon, who has led this work and is now pursuing this herself at the Babraham Institute. She was supported very much by Despina Stamatakis and Jorge Lazaro, and the work on the temporal program was the work of Andres Sagna when he was in the lab. And thank you for your attention.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.